direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe. It's the Raleigh James Show.
Friday night, the time is right for trivia. We'll get to that next hour and the hour after with your participation, though certainly some trivia involved in this hour. It came out yesterday officially. Likely you haven't read it. If you are any fan of rock and roll, you must. Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953 to 1968. It's the story of Clay Cole, and it is truly fascinating. You know, there's no shortage of books dealing with the first decades of rock and roll these days, and a lot of them are worthy of your time and attention, but I gotta tell you, this is the absolute first one that is 100% honest. All right, we used to laugh that we couldn't tell the stories until more people were dead so we wouldn't be sued, but dead or alive, they're both in here, I guarantee you. And as I say, if you even have a passing relationship with early rock and roll, you're going to want to read Shaboom. There's some things that'll make you absolutely laugh out loud, and there's other things that I think will surprise you, and some of them you will hear firsthand for yourself in moments. I've been sitting here for hours, and of course nothing's set up because I've been once again rereading Shaboom. I say rereading, read the whole thing when it came in, and want you to know that it's one of those books that you will read, but after you're done reading it, you're going to say, I got to read some of that again. It's absolutely like that. So you're about to hear some of the stories you've never heard, and a few of them that maybe you have.
The Raleigh James Show.
Yeah, but first I want to mention the Sea Crane Company. And, you know, if you are a fan of rock and roll, you know there's not a lot of places to hear it on the radio. You'd be amazed how much you can hear online. And you'd be even more amazed to know you can get a radio that'll take all those online streams and turn them into radio stations just for you. Yeah, it's a Wi-Fi radio, actually. Whether you're looking for the latest in conspiracy, whether it's Alex Jones or, hey, even my show, 24 hours a day, or whether you're looking for obscure oldies of any stripe, it's on there. Beach music, anyone? Charlie Brown's on there. You betcha. You want to hear the Beatles in Russian? That's on there, too, believe it or not. Now, the beauty of this is all you have to bring to the table is a broadband connection to the Internet, like a cable or a DSL modem. That's all you need to be able to listen just like it was magic. Over 16,000 things that aren't on your local or AM/FM radio. Now, if you go to ccradio.com, you can read all about Wi-Fi radio, see the technology, and also see what's out there. I got a couple tips for you. Firstly, whatever you buy, make sure it is based on the Receiva platform. I'd like to tell you they're magic, but they're based on a web portal, and Receiva is the one that not only has the most stations, but if you find something they don't have, they're easy to work with in getting it added, so that's neat. You also want something that not only is highly selective to any wireless access points, you can take it anywhere, but you want it to have an Ethernet port as well, so if you've got Cat 5 cable, you can use that, and much more. But what I'm talking about, of course, is the CC Wi-Fi of everything out there, and I am the Wi-Fi queen, I've got them all. The CC Wi-Fi, hands down, my favorite. Read about it. Hear what you've been missing on Wi-Fi radio. CCRadio.com anytime. CCRadio.com. But if you prefer to call, they will be back whenever you get up tomorrow. They'll be back in the office. Well, I say that, of course, whenever I get up, noon to 8 Eastern time or 9 to 5 Pacific. And they'll send you a catalog. Wi-Fi radio, the CC Wi-Fi from the Sea Crane Company. CCRadio.com. And you tell them that Raleigh sent you. Played them, he made them. It's Clay Cole. Welcome to the Raleigh James Show.
Ms. Raleigh, we finally meet.
Yes, this is just terrific. And I feel like I know you from your book because it's, you know, as I'm listening to Happy Times, I'm thinking that really belies the story on so many levels. For one thing, I was stunned to find out while you were making the rest of us happy, there were times you were plumb miserable doing this show.
Yeah, there is a darker side to rock and roll. You have to put on the happy face, though, Raleigh. You gotta keep them happy. It wasn't fun. The last 5 years, working on Channel 11 particularly, was very repressive. But I don't know how much of that story you want me to tell.
Oh, yeah, I got
but Happy
that.
Times I haven't heard in years. I thought it was recorded by Jim Lowe when I first heard it.
No, I gotta say that the Channel 11 story mirrors what many of us have had in our experience working in a situation where you're number one, you're absolutely the reason WPIX has revenue as far as I'm concerned, yet you have a general manager who in some level would wish you just disappeared, and if you didn't disappear, he certainly wished every black record you ever played would be off the air.
You said it precisely correct. The very idea that we had black performers on a rock and roll show repulsed him so much that he called me into his office thinking that he was going to thank me for the enormous ratings that we produced for them in the first year. So I figured this was going to be a congratulatory meeting because it was the first time I was ever invited into his sanctum sanctorum, the privileged offices of the general manager. So I sat down, he turned to me and said, "Why do you have to have so many pinheads on your show singing, 'It's all right, it's all right'? I mean, can't you have more white boys like the Beach Boys?" And I stared at him in disbelief, and he said, "Why, as a Southerner, I've done, but, you know," I didn't hear anything more because my heart started beating and my stomach was searing. And I think, not only is he a bigot, but he doesn't understand my audience at all. New Yorkers don't care about the Beach Boys, those sun-bleached vibrations they sing about. I mean, what kid in the Bronx wanted a little Deucey Coupe?
Well, you know.
I mean, the kids in the Bronx to a Woody had a whole different meaning. You know
yes,
I mean?
And Dion was
so, you know, he was way off
about.
Base in a million ways. But I could never tell anybody that story because no one would believe me except that I got collaboration from Ken Johnson,
yeah,
my producer, who was also called in and, as a matter of fact, went to Washington and testified against him in the hearings in front of the congressional hearings and looked him in the eye and said he told me we should just prove each one based on a photograph to see if they looked acceptable.
Which is heart-stopping. And as I say, not even remotely unusual, but along those same lines, the thing that made me laugh out loud in your book more than anything else you wrote was when your cameraman referred to little Anthony Imperials
and
said, "Last time they were here, they were white."
Yes. Last time they were here, they were white. And our director said, "What?" He said, "I said, the last time they were here, they wore white."
Oh.
And he was a Cuban cameraman, yeah. So that even made it funnier because of the accent.
That was...
Golly. I mean, you have to laugh at some of this because it's just, you know, too sad to even believe. I tell you what, though, I had... See, my ace in the hole was our ratings were so big that they had to put up with me. They were stuck with me, sort of. I did the first all-black show. This was in 1964, just as LBJ signed the Civil Rights Movement Act. I put on a salute to Motown with every act on the show was black. Marvin Gaye, Mary Wells, Martha the Vandellas, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight and the Pips, even the comic. We had Willie Tyler and Lester.
Yeah.
A whole hour was all black performers. I said, "I'll stick it to you." And of course, the ratings went through the roof on that one. Then, about 6 months later, when it was politically correct to put black artists on television because of the Civil Rights Movement, WPIX put out a press release to Variety, and on the front page it says, WPIX in the forefront of black artists, and they listed all the artists that were on my show with the president and general manager taking credit for it.
Of course, of course. That had to drive you to drink right there. Something about
I drank a lot in those days.
Well, yeah.
Well, we all did.
And, of course, it's interesting with New York because the basis of music as we know it, everything, post the pop standards, certainly was steeped in R&B. But even when Alan Freed had Frankie Lyman dancing with a white girl, that was the end of the whole show. So
that's the quintessential story. You're right.
Yes, it's a long history. And it didn't die there, unfortunately. It went on. I remember when I was working years later, I got called and he said, you played 3 black records in a row. I said, what were they? And one of them was Dionne Warwick, and I had a screaming fight saying she's not black. And of course her music wasn't. But that never went away. But the interesting thing is that when you'd look at some of your stills, if people hadn't watched the show and you hear things like Happy Times or some of the other stuff, you'd say, this is a quintessential white boy here. And then you find out that while someone's bragging that they know Little Richard, you know Little Walter. And, while other people are talking about these mass appeal venues, you're not only in the audience at the Apollo, you're later on stage at the Apollo. So I'm sure the people at PIX were apoplectic. But let's go back before that, because, of course, you unleashed your magic on New York in 1959 on Channel 13. Now, when you got there, of course, this is a year after these dance shows have gone national in the form of, sorry to say, Dick Clark, but they're a phenomena in every market. So now, of course, New York has to have one. Was Channel 13 expecting the results you gave them?
No, and this was the exciting part. I inherited a show that High Lit was doing. Mm-hmm. It was called Rate the Records. It was on in the afternoon. They had two high schools and four members of each school sat on a panel, and they would rate a brand new record. Now, how many different ways can a 16-year-old say, I like the beat, it's good to dance to, I like the lyrics? They liked everything.
Right.
And the record companies loved it because it got new exposure for their new releases. But I was a guy that had a very short attention span, and this show, after 2 weeks, was so boring to me that I had to break out. So I went to the station and tried to convince them to change the format. Well, what convinced them is that we had a contest. I said, I'm going to play a record. If you can tell me who the artist is on this record, send in a postcard. First 50 postcards gets a record album. 11,000 postcards came in 3 days.
Yeah.
Channel 13 gave me anything I wanted.
Yeah.
We switched the format. It became a free-willing show. We had stand-up comics. I danced with the black girls. I kissed Dionne Warwick. I hugged the Shirelles. I kissed Sammy Davis, for goodness sakes.
Yeah.
They couldn't care less. They were the best station I ever worked for. Eli Landau gave me so many opportunities. They gave me a new talent show on Sunday. 2 months later, they gave me a Saturday Night Hour that I held on to for 8 years. That was my big show. They were so supportive. It reminded me of what the old Hollywood studios must have been like, because we had Faye Emerson, Mike Wallace, David Susskind, Henry Morgan, all had shows. We all shared the same desk. We all helped each other, and it was a great experience, in contrast to Channel 11. But 13, those 3 years before they were sold to public broadcasting, were the best 3 years of my life.
That's so crushing when you've done so very well. And, of course, the only reason you were off the air is because they were becoming a PBS station, which is somewhat of a slap in the face. And so here you are off your literally highest success, and as far as any of these shows, probably the highest success anywhere. Your local ratings were bigger than Lloyd Thaxton's, for God's sake. So here you are, and now you're out of work. I'm sure you must have thought, I'll be back on in the air in a few weeks.
Well, I didn't really know how to market myself, and my agent, William Morris, said, well, let's capitalize on the fact that you just made a movie called Twist Around the Clock, which became a huge hit. It made $10 million just in the States, let alone South America and Europe. It was a huge hit, and I had the title song released on Imperial Records, Twist Around the Clock. So they sent me on a tour, to capitalize on the movie and keep me working. So we hired Lou Dane and the Furies, a wonderful show band, and the Capris had Moon Out Tonight, but they were very good friends of mine and talented, so we worked out an act with them. But we needed women, and the William Morris agent said, well, you know, I saw three girls at the Peppermint Lounge dancing. They were cute as hell. Why don't you take a look at them? So in walked Ronnie, Nedra, and Estelle, the Bennett sisters and cousins, who became the Ronettes.
Right.
And they had no act, so I found out that Ronnie could do a dead-on impression of Pearl Bailey, and the girls could swing a mean tambourine, and they had a nice little booty look going for themselves. So we did What I Say and Hit the Road, Jack. And before you knew it, we had a twist show called Twist-O-Rama, which sounds like an amusement park ride. I hated that, but that was a William Morris decision.
Right.
And so we toured, you know, for about 6 or 8 months, and then we got some out-of-the-country bookings that the young Ronettes couldn't handle. They were too young, 15, 16. So we brought in the Delicates, Denise Ferry and Peg Santiago, who were once with the Angels and the Delicates. They moved around and became session singers, too. But that's what kept me busy until Channel 11 came calling and 2 years later put me on.
Now, of course, between those two events was the fateful event, because here you are. You might be hip, but you're certainly not a drug smuggler. And here you wind up, and of all places, was it Newfoundland or Labrador? I don't remember which one. But
it was St. John's, Newfoundland, the Air Force base there. We were hired to do three nights. For the officers club, then the non-commissioned officers, and then for the regular grunts. So we had a week's actually booking in Newfoundland. And we were raided and accused of bringing marijuana onto not only federal property, but into another country.
Right.
And we were all arrested, interrogated. Our passports were taken away. Our flights were canceled. It was a horror show. And to tell you the truth, one of the members of the band, one of the members of the Delicates, and one of the members of the Capris was held for 2 months up there.
Oh, my God.
And so our show was absolutely, the rest of us were allowed to leave after like a week of house arrest. And I had to pay off all the promoters that had booked our show in the future. It cost me a fortune to, you know, pay the people because we couldn't perform. And as it turns out, the marijuana was sent to Ottawa to the labs, and it turned out it was oregano. The Italian boys had brought oregano with them, and there was no marijuana at all. These kids were still in jail for like 2 months, and of course the families blamed it on show business and, you know, bad influence it had. So it was a very bad period in my life because I all my savings and everything were gone. It cost me a fortune, but you know, sadly, it broke up the review because the kids, you know, they said their rosary beads and went on became angels.
Boyfriend's back. The interesting thing about this is, I was under the impression it was like decades before you found out that it was in fact oregano.
Well, it was decades later. I mean, I knew that I was innocent, but I told, oh, it's my fault. I brought it in, and they didn't believe me. And of course, I didn't. They found nothing except this little bag. I didn't find out, but I also found another thing decades later, when I was talking to one of the Delicates. She said, "Remember in the show we did the limbo?" I said, "Oh yeah, the Capris limbo rock. It was a big audience pleaser."
Right.
It turns out that somebody had actually stuffed marijuana in the limbo pole.
And they never found
it. It was a good hidey hole, you know. But they left it at the airport. They forgot it. And it was spinning around on the baggage claim area and probably, you know, just thrown away. But thank God it was, because if they had found it, they would have really gone to jail.
Well,
so years later, I found out, A, it was oregano, but B, someone actually tried to smuggle in marijuana in our limbo pool.
You had the last laugh on Canada, because when you left WPIX, for a moment there, a Canadian replaced you.
wouldn't you know that they would hire the wrong person?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, surely, I knew that when I was 30 years old, a mantra was, you know, don't trust anyone over 30. And I was 30 when I left, and I thought, you know, it's time for a younger person to take over the show. And, of course, they hired the wrong young person. They hired this kid from Canada, very good-looking kid named Peter Martin, whose father was sort of like the Bing Crosby of Canada. But I knew this kid didn't have a chance in hell. In this, you know, New York is a very hip town, and these kids that watch my show are very hip, and this kid just is not going to make it. And sure enough, he quit about 6 weeks later. And then they hired, ta-da, a black man,
Frankie Crocker.
The hottest, handsomest disc jockey in New York to replace me. This irony on top of irony. But he failed. Even though he had a very deep Rolodex, he could call on anybody, James Brown and little all his friends. But the show failed, and 8 months later was canceled. Then it suddenly struck me that, gosh, maybe they tuned in to see me because they liked me. You know,
yeah.
I finally began to think, to realize what a role I played in the show. People tuned in because they liked me, they trusted me, and they liked how I did the show.
Absolutely. Now, are you saying
that reward came about a year later, but I really believe that. Someone once told me, you know, Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, they all have the same show, they have the same desk, the same couch. Why is it that some of them fail, like Joey Bishop, and some of them, like Chevy Chase, fail, and the other ones succeed? Same guest, same couch, same chair. It's the host.
Of course it
Whether
is.
Whether you like the host or not. You like, we love Mike Douglas, you don't like Joey Bishop. You know.
Of course.
You like Johnny, you don't like Chevy Chase. So some succeed, some don't. I think it's the host factor. You like the host, you trust the host, and you tune in to see the host.
Yeah, there's an X factor there, because it's not what they say and it's not what they're wearing or how they look. There's something deeper than that just comes across. And
yeah,
you had that quality on that show. But as I was saying, what's interesting is your depth was further than the average viewer saw. Now, clearly they knew that you weren't a la Dick Clark. They knew you got it. They knew you understood the records. When you were introducing Jackie Wilson, you could actually sing along with it, unlike, as you mentioned in your book, Ed Sullivan. But on the other hand, I don't think many of those teens actually knew, for instance, I mentioned before Little Walter, that you were a Little Walter fan, because your depth of music went deeper and more into R&B than even the show represented.
Well, yeah, I still had to be mainstream,
sure,
you know, in presenting my show. But, you know, I really always resented it when people casually say the Clay Cole Show is like American Bandstand. You know, they try to give it that kind of a description. We were unlike Bandstand
in every way.
Soul Train was different than the Catholic Hour. I mean, we had nothing to do with Bandstand. We presented comics, for instance, like Richard Pryor and Dick and George Carlin and John Viner and Fanny Flagg.
Sure.
No other show, rock and roll show, had a stand-up comic every week. And we did such hip things like the Clay's Coal Bin, where all the acts did crazy blackouts and sketches and sight gags. I mean, it was a freewheeling, very hip, sophisticated show that probably would have only worked in New York. And, you know, I sort of resent that they just sort of wipe it away. It's like a Dick Clark show.
Well, you know, one rock and roll record's the same as another rock and roll record, Clay, after all.
Yeah, exactly.
We have Clay Cole with us. The book is wonderful, and you must get it. Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953 to 1968. We will pick it up right there on The Raleigh James Show.
It's The Raleigh James Show. Skip to my loop, oh, skip to my loop, my darling. what's about to happen. That obscure song only you remember is going to be played on the radio. Friday Night Trivia on The Raleigh James Show.
Don't come a-calling, I don't need you. Don't come a-calling,
Indeed. Clay called, you betcha. And the flip side of Here, There, and Everywhere, no, not that one, on Roulette, Teddy Van wrote it. I'm sure there's plenty of stories there. You will not believe the stories in Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953 to 1968. You'll love the descriptions. Yes, Wayne Newton, Doris Day in drag. But I think the line that really got me in the entire book came right toward the beginning when Clay Cole said, "They gave me the keys to the city, but they were about to change the locks." And that says it all. And that's exactly where we will pick it up in moments, right here on The Raleigh James Show.
The Raleigh James Show.
All right. I want to talk about firing the phone company for a moment because it's such a wonderfully delicious idea and we've wanted to do it for years, let's face it. Now, I'm not talking about using your computer as your phone or some USB jack or something ridiculous like that. I want you to keep the same phone you've been using all along, even if it's the pink princess in the bedroom. I want you to keep the same phone number that you've always had. I'm just going to let you fire the phone company, save a bunch of money, improve your quality. And, well, so far I'm talking about something that a lot of people have been offering you of late if you have a broadband connection, and you've got to. If you have that broadband connection, there's no shortage of digital phone, alternative phone, VoIP phone offers. But I'm here to tell you, only one of them will offer you customer service. The kind of customer service you got long before anybody knew what broadband was. Everything done in the United States of America. No menus and messages and prompts and recordings or anything like that. Real people. We're talking about VYL Media. VYLmedia.com. They are incredible. Firstly, you can trust me because your entire sign-up is $1 and you have no commitment and no contract. So if you want to check this out and you decide I'm wrong, you're out a dollar. That's all there is to it. Now, what do you pay a month? $23.97 for unlimited calls to the United States and Canada. No catches. Every feature you've ever had, your voicemail and call waiting and caller ID and anonymous call rejection, and if you name a feature, you've got it. You also can have virtual phone numbers. Let's say you used to live in Philadelphia, but now you're living in Los Angeles. Well, keep your local Los Angeles number, but get a Philly number as well for your friends and family still back there. They'll dial their 7-digit number in area 215. You'll answer and say 310, and nobody will pay anything. It is an unbelievable deal, and you can have as many as you want, and there's no charge for them. As far as quality, you know, we switched to it on the air to improve our quality. We finally gave up on the phone company and their 60 hertz hums, and they're telling us that, oh, it's within tolerance. It's 29 dB of noise. We went to VYL Media, cleared it up instantly. So you get better quality. You save incredibly on prices. And by the way, it's easy. What happens is they mail you a device, you plug it into your modem, you plug the phone into it. That's all there is to it. Now, if you think there's a catch, I want you to know the tech support is 24/7 in the United States of America. You call, they answer, they help you. The business office, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Central Time. Again, somebody answers right away, gives you their name and their phone extension and their email address. So, yes, it's an honest-to-God contact. They are more than anything I could tell you. It is time to fire the phone company. Write down this phone number. Call them Monday. Prove me right on the customer service. 888-369-8647. 888-369-VOIP. Or go online right now and look around. That is VYLmedia.com. VYLmedia.com. If you're a business customer, you know what the phone company's been socking it to you. You can save a fortune. And if you're looking for DSL service, depending on where you live, they might be able to hook you up with that too. VYLmedia.com. You tell them that Raleigh sent you. And we, obviously, with that, are speaking with Clay Cole. So Mozart at the end of the show, that's a little daring.
Little Mozart. Yeah. It sounds like the Swingle Singers.
It exactly was the Swingle Singers. And
cool.
You closed with that every show. And I think you have the distinction of being the only top 40-oriented show to close with Mozart.
Well, do you know something? That record won a Grammy,
yeah,
and became a huge hit in America.
Yeah.
And we seemed to be the only one playing it. I was absolutely shocked and amazed, and so were they, to tell you the truth.
Now, what I found interesting, of course, is the dirt. I just love the dirt. I laughed hearing you recall Gloria Stavers and her casting couch for 16 magazine.
Yes.
But the one that I was so pleased with, as I mentioned many times in passing when conversations have come about Alan Freed, I said, hey, I can't talk to New York, but I can tell you what, in Cleveland, he was a crossdresser, and people would look at me like I'd lost my mind. And here it was in the book. Not only was he a crossdresser, but tell us the pool story.
Well, the story goes that his particular peccadillo was that he liked to be dressed in women's clothes submerged in water. As a matter of fact, when I went to his house in Stamford, his stepdaughter sort of nudged me and pointed to the shower. He had built in his shower this circular spiral snake that, you know, went from the top of the shower all wrapped around to the bottom, so that when you got in the shower, the water hit you from, you know, every part of your body from head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kids were walking around the house in these enormous high heels. So she sort of winked and nudged and, you know, see these big shoes. Well, the story was is that when Alan was a small child, his mother dressed him in little pinafores and immersed him in the bassinet full of water, and somehow that got translated into a Freudian kind of preference.
Yeah.
So, but what amazed me is that he found three wives, perhaps,
right,
that indulged him in being a swan queen to his rubber ducky.
Well, you're assuming they knew it before the nuptials.
Well, I guess they would have to.
Not necessarily. You
have more dirt than I do because you go back to Cleveland. I don't know. This came to me from his stepdaughter who confided in me. And Hannah Weiner was her best friend and cousin, who was a psychotherapist who knew all about it. So they related the story to me and then proved it by taking me up to Stamford to Greycliff, where Alan lived, and showed me all the little nooks and crannies in this little perversion of his.
Well, the best part was the party where apparently someone accidentally fell into the pool, and the promo guys, proving they would do anything to get a record on a show, pushed their wives fully dressed into the pool.
Well, that's a famous story, except people don't know the,
why?
The subtext to it.
Yeah.
But when one lady went in the pool, Alan Freed's eyes lit up, and he just seemed to love it. So everybody wanted to please Alan. Everybody pushed their wives into the pool.
Right.
And all these women in the diamonds and furs, the furs were floating on top, diamonds were dropping to the bottom, and Alan was getting his little jollies. This was, you know, his wet dream come true.
Yeah, so, literally. Yes, on every facet, literally. You betcha.
But you read any book about Alan Freed, by the way, the very best one is John Jackson's
yes.
Big Beat Heat. That's
yes.
just a quintessential, I mean, the best research book ever.
But that's not in there.
He left that out.
Yeah.
I had filled John in on that little part. But anybody that knows, read anything about Alan Freed, they'll tell you about that famous party with the people going in the pool, but nobody mentions that he was getting his kicks over that Fellini-esque episode.
And I was so delighted you did. That's one of the reasons why I say everybody's got to read this book. You don't pull any punches. I love the way you describe Wayne Newton as Doris Day in drag. That's just classic.
He was blonde then.
Yeah.
Right now he's, you know, black hair for the last 40 years, but when he was a young country bumpkin singing and playing the banjo at the Copa, he was blonde hair, you know, little toe-headed kid, but he was enormous. He had a huge head, and he was about 6'4". And everybody used to laugh when he put on a tuxedo. He looked exactly like Doris Day in drag.
Yeah. Now, it's
that
also
was what we whispered.
Also fascinating to me that you spanned an interesting era, just like a guy like Bob Horn went from the pop standards right into rock and roll and survived. You came out of prior to the Beatles, kind of the line of demarcation, and post-Beatles at a time, and granted, you walked away in 68, and I certainly understand that, but nonetheless, you managed to get through that period and remain relevant, and that had to be no small feat. In terms of that, what changed during that period?
Well, I think the thing that hurt me most was how the disc jockeys in America turned their back on American artists and embraced only British acts. I mean, if you're looking at TV Guide, my show had certainly its share of the British invasion groups, but we also managed to include the new releases by the Shirelles, the Duprees, Little Anthony, and Bobby V. And we kept the American artists front and center as well. Most disc jockeys and radio stations eliminated from their playlist any American acts. They were so into trying to be the fifth Beatle or the WA Beatles C or All Beatles All the Time station that they totally neglected all the American acts. The only two that broke through constantly were the Beach Boys and the Four Seasons. Mm-hmm. But I think, my theory in the book is, and I know you're a big Shag and Beach music aficionado, I believe that saved the American a cappella vocal harmony groups because they had no voice in the mid-60s. But because Gus Gossard came up with his tag called doo-wop, and because Beach Music and Shag at the same time was embracing that music, it gave the vocal harmony groups that were pushed aside by the disc jockeys of America, they were given a whole new life, a whole new audience, and a whole new paycheck, and they're still performing today. Mm-hmm. All those acts are now celebrating 50 years, but if it hadn't have been for the emergence of Shag, Beach Music, and doo-wop, I think they would have been eliminated and just written off.
Well, it's interesting because post-Beatles, post-British Invasion, when things started to get into the dreaded psychedelic period, which I'd have left with you. But
yeah,
when,
that turned me right off.
Right, me too. When and that, it didn't have a beat and you couldn't dance to it. But the interesting thing for radio radio stations was that you had two choices because as the underground stations were coming on, you know, the top 40 stations weren't going to go four deep into Lou Reed or something. So what they had to do was either decide they were going to be harder and whiter, or they were going to be softer and blacker. And that's when you were seeing in the South more of the Motown catalog, the Velvets, groups like the Flirtations coming on, because it was either that or bubblegum. So you're right. Beach music in the South was huge. But you go to some place like, you know, Utah, and there were 30-year-old women saying, yeah, AC/DC, I think they're great. So it sort of went both ways because it was a schism where mainstream rock and roll, and by that time, even the Beach Boys and the Four Seasons were starting to lag, really was becoming bubblegum, and that would kill you.
Yeah. Boy, you are so knowledgeable about music. You just thrill me. You know, in my circle of friends, I'm the king of trivia. Mm. But when I listen to you, you wipe me right out. I'm Gumby. I have no idea some of the things that you come up with. But I kind of also have a kind of an edge that I say in the book. I was born at the, some people are born at exactly the right time, and I was born before the baby boom explosion, so that I had the very last taste of the big band music. My uncles would play, you know, the Modern Airs and Tex Beneke and Glenn Miller. That's so vivid in my head. Then I saw the pop emergence of Rosemary Clooney, Patti Page, Eddie Fisher, Perry Como, stepping out from the big bands, Frank Sinatra. So I had a taste of all of that before rock and roll came onto my playlist. When I was 15, I was doing a music show on television in Ohio, playing Rosemary Clooney and the McGuire sisters and the Hilltoppers. And all of a sudden, Shaboom came along, and the Everly Brothers, and Chuck Berry, and Fats Domino. And before you know it, I'm doing a rock and roll show. So I had the best of both worlds. I had the very end of the big band era, the pop music era, and then the rock and roll era.
And you were in a great place for that, too, because Youngstown, you could play Shaboom next to Joni James, for instance. In many ways, people think of Ohio not being hip, but Youngstown had a hipness to it that was undeniable. So being at KBN-TV was no small feather in your cap at 15.
Well, that's where Alan Freed lived, 7 miles away from the station in Salem, Ohio. I lived 7 miles away from the station in Hubbard. He started there at WKBN 10 years before me doing sports before he moved to Akron to do classical music, before he moved to Cleveland where the Mint Boys turned him into a rhythm and blues DJ.
Sure.
But, you know, I think he didn't like, honestly, I think he didn't really like it. He just played it because the sponsor made him, but he got to love it when he saw the rewards in record hops and the coronation balls and all that stuff. He then became the lover of rock and roll, but I just think he went along for the ride and fell into it.
Yeah, I would agree with that initially, big time. But I think ultimately he had a certain amount of integrity. And I'm not saying he didn't take money, he absolutely did. But one of the things about Alan Freed was he was more likely to want it after he wanted to play the record. He was one of the few who, you got the idea, he was listening to the record, much like a John R. on WLAC. You know, this was a guy who actually turned the monitors up when the songs they liked came on. So no doubt that it was a living for him off the air in ways that the fans were unaware. But at the same time, you know, compared to a lot that were out there, he got to a point where, yeah, I think ultimately he did like it.
Oh, absolutely. And got to love it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, and that's to his credit. And I think in some ways, while he clearly wasn't a naive man, there was a streak of honesty that kind of hung him at a time when other people were skating. Now, that was also interesting because here you come into New York in 1959, and the Paola hearings are coming a year later, but we know it's coming. And I would assume at that point, you talked about this somewhat in your book, that you thought initially with your manager you were going to go to Channel 13 and kind of be vertically integrated, so to speak. Before you even got on the air, that was over, wasn't it?
Well, I went on the air September 10th. That was 50 years ago last month. Signed on September 10th with Rate the Records. By November, Alan was off the air.
Yes.
Big Beat show was canceled. It was an ABC radio show was canceled, and he was finished. I was on the air only 2 months. I didn't even have a chance, even if I wanted to take Paola.
Right, yeah.
I was too fresh, too new.
Right.
So by that time, Alan was off. There was a freeze on. Every station in New York was afraid to do a teenage rock and roll show. So I had the city all to myself.
Yeah. What a great.
Alan was gone, and nobody would.
Yeah.
Go up against me. Everybody was terrified, and there I was, clean cut. All-American kid doing my little thing on Saturday night. So
yeah, timing-wise, it was absolutely God's gift. Yeah, it was God's gift to you. It couldn't have been better. That is absolutely true. But again, here comes timing. And, you know, while, yes, the psychedelic era was horrible, and like I say, I would have run with you, something else was happening at the time, and that was the naivete and the small businessman, the Moish Levy's of the world, were kind of being now turned out. They're gone, and now it's big business, because after the Beatles, albums are selling. Now there's actual dollars in this, unlike 1959. When it was a 45 world. So with that in mind, was some of the corporatization of it also a turnoff?
Well, it absolutely turned the business around. I mean, the days that I remember best were when five guys from Brooklyn could walk up Broadway, knock on George Goldner's door, mm-hmm. go in, see George, sing a song for him, and George will say, yeah, I'll record you. They get down to a $100 an hour recording studio and put out a record.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do that today. Today it's a $1 billion business. You can't even get an audition with a full-blown demo tape.
Right.
But then back it was a mom-and-pop record stores, all mafia-run and mafia jukebox connections and all that stuff. And it was a whole different world. It was free and easy and breezy and street kids could get a break just by inventing a song and singing it in front of a little tin can microphone.
But you saw what was coming when you left in 68, because by then, now it's becoming big business. The world was changing in ways that much of what was between the grooves of the records, which made it exciting, and that buy the CD your pants, and it just because it feels good, what am I going to lose, $100, that was out the window by the time you walked.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing is, I couldn't relate to people who were walking into my studio.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, little Anthony would come in, Jay and the Americans come in. Oh, we had so much to talk about. But all of a sudden, these scraggly kids were coming in with, you know, stoners and ripped jeans and torn T-shirts. And, you know, were you going to change into your tuxedos, boys?
You know.
The only ones that I could really relate to were the Love and Spoonful. Now, they were all Greenwich Village street kids from New York, so and with a great sense of humor.
Right.
And I loved them, and I got along great. But I mean, some of these acts, they've come in, and I how can you even begin to interview them? I couldn't relate to them. I couldn't relate to the music. I couldn't relate to their drugs. I didn't like the hard rock, the heavy metal, the psychedelic rock. I mean, it was just time to go. It was not my kind of show business. I summarize it by saying, I was a black tie tuxedo guy lost in a tie-dye T-shirt world.
Yes. Yes, and it really was, as you say, they gave you the keys and changed the locks, and that's exactly what happened. And we've gotten away from psychedelia, but we've never been able to come back to when it really was worthless, when $100 right. would buy you a record, and that that energy is what will never be returned. So yes, you absolutely were in the right place at the right time. Now, I can't believe we've gone through an hour and I didn't even get to some of the stuff I really wanted to talk about, because while people thought you just died in 68, reinventing yourself, especially after being so visible in front of the camera, is no small thing. So can we have you back for part two?
Oh, I'll do anything for you. You've been so kind and grateful. I'm just so grateful that you liked the book.
Oh, I love the book.
Said such nice things about it. I'm stunned. Yeah. I am so grateful. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a terrific book, Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll, 1953 to 68. I've got your website, claycoleshow.com, a link at mine on raleigh.net, but easy to remember, claycoleshow.com. I've also got a link to Amazon for a good price, so you can buy it right at claycoleshow.com. And I have a feeling this is going to sell very well. The minute people in the industry start seeing what you said, this is going to catch on like wildfire, Clay.
Oh. I hope so. Say it to Vox style. Remember that?
Absolutely. You betcha. So, yes, and thank you for mentioning beach music in the book. That was a wonderful shout-out. So we will do part two, because I can't wait to hear about the 3,500 television shows that people don't realize you were involved with.
Talking to you would be a pleasure again.
All right. Good luck, Clay. Thank you. We'll talk soon. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All righty. So Clay Cole, it is. It's a great book. And for the Alan Freed story alone, I actually felt kind of vindicated for that, because I've so many times said, well, you know, he was a cross-dresser. And people are like, he's a what? Said, yeah. So it's in Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll. Not that that's why you want to remember Alan Freed, of course, but just little tidbits like that make it a lot of fun. But there's a lot of other stories that I guarantee you, you'll come away with, no kidding, really? On more than a handful of stories. So that's where it is, Shaboom, The Explosion of Rock and Roll. The Explosion of Trivia is coming up next. Oh, we didn't even get to talk about Teddy Van, who wrote his we played at Skip Skip and Here, There, and Everywhere. But I was looking through Teddy Van records earlier. I couldn't believe I found the theme from Colored Man. And what I didn't realize till I played it again, maybe I'll have to play it one night for you, is the voice on it for the theme from Colored Man is James Earl Jones. It's too good. Just absolutely too good. All right, well, so is Shaboom, and so is Trivia, so start dialing 610 640 6400 610 640 6400 right here on the Raleigh James Show.
It's the Raleigh James Show.